ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 10th of November. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. John Laws, the veteran radio broadcaster, died. He was 90 years old. He was known as the Golden Tonsils, and he's being remembered this morning as one of the pioneers of Australian talkback radio after more than 70 years on the airwaves. He finally retired November last year. Barney Porter looks back.
Hello, world. This is John Laws.
John Laws started his radio career in the 1950s, when the DJ was king. He mixed with celebrities, was among the first presenters to play rock and roll, and even flirted with pop stardom himself, releasing several albums.
I don't think I'm all that good a singer to make a living out of it. I like singing and I enjoy doing occasional TV appearance and I like making a couple of records.
And then there was the poetry with that voice.
The sweat drops to the sheet and goes spreading slowly like warmth. Drops of love being soaked up the way your love absorbed me.
Hence the nickname, the Golden Tonsils. Notwithstanding the dulcet tones, it was live radio where he really made his mark.
Long John's party line, hello? Yes, it is. Speak up.
In the late 1960s, he transformed himself into a radio talk show host and a burgeoning shock jock.
The way I used to do that in the first talk program I did was to be rude to them, and then they would react.
He was regularly controversial, sharing opinions he knew would rankle. In an interview with 7:30's Lee Sales in 2017, he reflected on his career and opined further on Princess Di.
I didn't like her from the beginning. I thought she was an actress. No, she didn't do much for me.
And why he preferred spending time with women rather than men.
What is it that you enjoy about the company of women?
They talk more.
Over the years, he spoke to a legion of luminaries.
Do I have Ray Charles on the telephone?
You certainly do.
Peter Allen, good morning.
Hi, John, how are you?
Jack Nicholson, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Tony Bennett is the best around.
How are you, Tony?
I'm just fine, thank you.
Liberace, good morning.
Thanks, John.
Good to see you.
Real nice pleasure.
Betty Davis.
How are you? Do get here, we must meet.
I would like that very much. Kirk Douglas.
I'm a little sad that I can't be there for the opening of Man from Snowy River, but I hope you'll be there representing me. Will you do that?
Sure I will.
Yoko Ono. Hi, Yoko, how are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
And PMs aplenty.
Prime Minister of Australia, Mr. Malcolm Fraser, good morning.
Good morning.
Prime Minister of Australia, Bob Hawke.
Good morning, John.
Mr. Gough Whitlam, good morning.
Good morning, John.
And then there were his regulars, like Norman.
I see we have a Norman. I wonder, is it the Norman? Norman, are you there?
Yeah, I want to know.
It is the Norman.
Yeah, I want to know, why are you still on air? You know, you follow Kyle for everything. Are you going on a Cohen affair as well? Are you going to dress up as a bunny in a bunny suit as well?
Norman, the good thing about you is you don't have to dress up as a bunny. You are one.
Irreverent, rude, condescending, and always entertaining. Along the way over the decades, he also became one of the most powerful broadcasters in the country, with an ability to influence public opinion and therefore the news agenda. He even won a Kennedy Award for outstanding contribution to journalism, although he never claimed to be a journo, and in his acceptance speech, he wondered why he'd received it. That attitude perhaps led to arguably the greatest blight on his career, the cash for comment controversy in the early 2000s. Some of his ads were obvious.
Valvoline, you know what I mean.
But others weren't so clear-cut, particularly his relationship with Telstra. The Broadcasting Authority found Mr. Laws repeatedly breached the industry code by making favourable comments about the telco under the guise of merely expressing an opinion in return for money. The veteran broadcaster was unrepentant.
There wasn't cash for comment. Nobody received cash. The comments weren't comments, they were commercials, and it was a legitimate commercial arrangement.
There were other transgressions. He was handed a 15-month suspended sentence for breaking the law by interviewing a jury member on the radio. He was also found guilty of vilifying homosexuals after an on-air discussion about a gay couple on a reality TV show.
We all make mistakes. I mean, you're looking at one of the great mistake makers of the world.
In 2007, after more than 50 years on the airwaves, a decline in ratings finally prompted him to hang up the headphones.
In breaking news, legendary broadcaster John Laws has announced his retirement from radio. The golden mic, soon to be put away forever.
Time to say goodbye.
It's time to do it. And I'll miss it very much. I really will miss it very much.
It didn't last too long. In the grand tradition of Dame Nellie Melba, he came back to the airwaves 4 years later, becoming the regular morning presenter on Sydney's 2SM by popular demand.
I felt I owed it to the people who were loyal, because when I did give it up, people would stop me all the time in the street and, when are you going to go back? And that kind of loyalty you can't buy.
John Laws was married three times. He leaves five children.
And all I can say is that I thank you for listening, and I hope you can be kind to each other.
The late John Laws, Barney Porter reporting. The BBC's Director General, Tim Davey, and its news chief executive, Deborah Turness, have resigned over the criticism the way the broadcaster edited a speech by the United States President Donald Trump aired in a Panorama documentary. Europe correspondent Catherine Diss joined me earlier. Catherine, why have these two key figures at the BBC quit?
Good morning, Sabra. Well, look, this is big news. This all comes after a newspaper report in The Telegraph last week, which published details of a leaked internal BBC memo, which suggested that the broadcaster's Panorama program, which is an investigative show much like Four Corners, edited two parts of Trump's speech together. So he appeared to explicitly encourage the Capitol riots of January 2021. Now, this was when he was previously president, and he was giving that speech ahead of the storming of the US Capitol. The leaked memo came from Michael Prescott. He's a former independent external advisor to the broadcaster's editorial standards committee. He raised concerns over the documentary, Trump, A Second Chance, which was broadcast last year, and it was made for the BBC by the independent production company October Films. So these two soundbites are believed to have been some 50 minutes apart in the actual speech, but were edited together.
And what have the former BBC Director General and Head of News said this morning about this?
Yeah, look, we've heard from the Director General of the BBC, Tim Davey. Obviously, he's now leaving the position after 5 years. He's released a statement after spending 20 years at the company saying that it's entirely his decision to leave, but there have been some mistakes made, and as Director General, I have to take ultimate responsibility. He's thanked the chair and board for their support throughout this period as well. He says the BBC is not perfect and it must always be open, transparent and accountable. Whilst not his only reason, the current debate around the BBC has understandably contributed to his decision to leave.
It's Catherine Diss there. New research shows trust in Australia's democratic systems is diminishing, and the sentiment is being markedly felt more outside of the nation's major cities and among young people. Experts say the findings are cause for concern and more needs to be done to strengthen our democracy. Erin Somerville reports.
Regional Victorian teenager Riley Williams can't wait to cast an election vote.
I feel like I've got some research to do before I commit to any or any parties, but it should be exciting.
But new research shows young country Australians are a key demographic losing faith in democracy. For Riley, it's not surprising.
People blame a lot of problems on the government, whether it is or isn't their fault. I think that can disengage them a bit and make them think that there must be better options.
The inaugural McKinnon Index, released today by the not-for-profit organisation, is its first annual snapshot gauging Australia's attitudes on democracy. It shows those living outside of major cities have less faith in the system. Young rural and remote men have the lowest confidence in elections, while young regional women are overrepresented in not understanding how democracy works. McKinnon Executive Director and former South Australian Premier Jay Weatherill says it's a wake-up call.
The numbers of people that don't understand our system
or don't fully support it. They're in minority, but that's a significant minority.
The research shows 66% of those in major cities and 62% in inner regional areas believe election outcomes are fair. But in outer regional and remote Australia, it drops to under 53%, while 65% say they don't feel understood by federal politicians. Here's what some regional Australians had to say about it.
They don't listen to nobody. All they want is their payment at the end of the week.
We're fairly removed and distant geographically from federal politics, I think.
Experts say lower education levels, frustration with government service delivery and declining local media outlets is driving down democratic trust outside major cities. Professor Nicholas Biddle at the Australian National University says there's been a long-term decline in Australians' confidence in democracy, and Labor being in federal government is driving some of the sentiment.
Regional and remote areas whose members at the moment are more likely to be in opposition, that kind of feeds into their trust and confidence in democracy and the system.
He added Australia should be proud of its democratic institutions, but not take them for granted.
If we want that to remain, then we need to continue to reinvest, continue to innovate, and also really identify what are the real policy challenges, what are the real issues which people are identifying in their lives, and have a targeted focus on those.
Professor Nicholas Biddle from the Australian National University, ending Erin Somerville's report. Senator Don Farrell is the Federal Special Minister of State with oversight of the Australian Electoral Commission and Parliamentary Services. He spoke with me earlier. Don Farrell, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Sabra.
The McKinnon survey involved 4,000 Australians, and it shows that people are supportive and engaged in our democracy, but there are worrying signs. Nearly a quarter of Australians say democracy is not preferable, and nearly 10% say violence can be justified for a political cause. Does that worry you?
In terms of the support for democracy, I'd look at it the other way, that more than 76% of Australians support democracy. And again, on the other issue, of course, overwhelmingly, Australians overwhelmingly, they're opposed to violence. That 10% figure, I agree with you, is a worrying figure, but overwhelmingly Australians are opposed to violence in the political system.
But still, the one in four say that democracy is not preferable.
You've really got to look at the total number, and I think the total number does give us some cause for confidence. So I think that's a sign that basically most Australians, overwhelmingly Australians, do support our democracy. We're trying to do a range of things that improve the support for our democracy. You might recall, Sabra, during the last term of the government, we put through a range of transparency measures that now mean that when you go into the to vote at the next election, you'll know exactly who's supporting the candidate that you might be thinking about voting for. So for the first time in the history of a federal government in Australia, we'll have real-time disclosures of donations. We've also reduced the figure that you now have to disclose. Previously it was $17,000. Now it's $5,000. So any donation above that level must now be fully disclosed in advance of the election. The other things we've done, of course, is to put downward pressure on the cost of elections by limiting the amount of money people can donate to a candidate and limiting the money amount of money that people can spend on a campaign. So I think a combination of that figure of 76% plus the things that we're doing in before the next election, I think are an indication that we should be reasonably positive about support for democracy in this country.
What about 62% said they believe corruption is a problem in federal politics, with only 14% disagreeing, and 56% feel that politicians really don't understand or represent them?
Yeah, look, those figures are uncomfortable, I guess, again. We tried to do something in the last parliament by introducing a national anti-corruption commission, and I think that's doing its work and is working well.
Because some people pointed out very recently, actually, that it's been in operation for 2 years. It's got an annual budget of $60 million. It's had 5,000 referrals and not one major finding yet of corruption.
Well, that's a good sign. I would have said after that number of inquiries, it hasn't discovered any corruption. It means that people have the opportunity of putting their claims for corruption forward and it being investigated. And then if no charges are laid, well, that's an indication that the system is working. There is no corruption. And I say that's a good thing.
Have the traditional parties played a role here? Primary support has dropped for the major parties, traditional parties, markedly during the past 20 years. Voters say they're not being listened to, that inequality is growing, not narrowing. And they see Question Time, which is a narrow window on what happens in Parliament. But many voters think that's unacceptable and Parliament's not working for them.
Look, I think Question Time is one of the key features of our democracy. It's a way in which particularly the opposition parties and the crossbenchers get to question the government of the day about issues that are concerning them and concerning their constituents. I think it's a couple of weeks ago I was in the chair when we had the longest question time in Australian parliamentary history. Let's think, 3.5 hours. No question time had gone longer than that. I actually think Question Time provides the community. Okay, it's a narrow window, but it is a window where the Prime Minister has to turn up. That doesn't often happen in other countries, certainly not to the same extent. So the Prime Minister has to be there. He's got to be there every day and answering questions. And I think that's a good part of our democracy. I would have thought that you know, should garner more support from the community.
Don Farrell, thanks for joining AM.
Nice talking with you, Sabra.
And Senator Don Farrell is the Federal Special Minister of State. Some people say we're wasting electricity. Others say it's merely a sign of a normal renewable energy system. However it's perceived, Australia is often capable of generating more wind and solar power than it's actually producing because there's not enough demand to soak up all of the supply. And it's a gap that's growing as more renewable energy is added to the grid. Energy reporter Daniel Mercer explains.
On a breezy day in Western Australia's rural south, something seems amiss. There's a stiff breeze blowing over the wheat and barley crops, with the blades on giant wind turbines, each capable of powering thousands of homes at a time, are barely turning at all. There's nothing wrong with them, there's just nowhere for their power to go.
Curtailment, in its simplest, is when an energy asset generates less than it would be capable of generating.
Pete Tickler is the co-founder of energy analysis firm GridCog. He says curtailment is increasingly becoming a feature of Australia's power systems. It can happen when there's simply not enough demand to soak up all the supply renewable energy could provide, leading big commercial wind or solar farms to partially or fully switch off. It's most pronounced in the middle of mild, sunny days, when the output from Australia's vast fleet of rooftop solar floods onto the system, pushing out most other generators.
We shouldn't underestimate just what an amazing achievement it is to get 40% of homes and businesses with rooftop solar, but it sets the rhythm for the wholesale energy markets in Australia, because when there's a lot of rooftop solar, that suppresses the demand that the rest of the market sees.
Chris O'Keefe is the national spokesman for the Clean Energy Council, which represents renewable energy developers. He says the effects of curtailment are not lost on his members.
It is happening quite a fair bit, and it's a byproduct of an ever-changing grid.
At the moment, curtailment isn't a particularly big part of Australia's electricity system, accounting for only about 1.5% in missed wind and solar production last year. But it can be much more than that at times, and with household solar installations increasing, there are expectations it'll grow markedly in the years ahead. Chris O'Keefe says there are steps renewable energy developers can take to offset the risks, such as expanding the poles and wires network.
I think our members understand that curtailment is part and parcel of the investment decisions that they make when they decide to build wind or solar projects.
Pete Tickler from GridCog says home and large-scale batteries will help soak up much of the excess supply, as will consumers who shift more of their use to the middle of the day. The federal government announced a scheme that would offer free electricity in the middle of the day, encouraging people to use power when the chance of curtailment is at its highest.
Daniel Mercer there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. You may or may not have noticed in the corner of a shopping centre or in a convenience store, the crypto ATM. There are thousands of them, which makes sense because there's a crypto boom. Today, business reporter Rhianna Whitson on how they're increasingly being used to scam innocent Australians out of millions of dollars. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.